G'day, welcome to the Earshot podcast with me, David Rutledge. Over summer, we're playing our highlight programs from the past 12 months, so strap yourself in because we're about to jump back a couple of centuries to France in the year 1817. This was a time when women were strictly forbidden from going on voyages of exploration. But Rose de Freycinet defied the authorities. Her husband was about to head across the Pacific to Sydney, and so she disguised herself as a man and sneaked on board. She also, very fortunately for our purposes, kept a journal. In this program, producer Ros Bluett will be turning the pages of that journal, but we begin with a letter.
Ma mère, j'ai pris ma décision.
Mother, my mind is made up. I will follow my husband in his expedition around the world. I will share his fate and I will soften his anxieties. But I confess, the thought of that sea frightens me.
And so Rose's three-year journey across the world was decided, with her husband, Captain Louis de Freycinet, on board the Uranie. She wrote letters to her mother and kept a journal for her friend Caroline. As a result, an unofficial, French and decidedly feminine view of the voyage emerged. Rose's journal has just been acquired by the State Library of New South Wales, as it includes unique observations of Sydney in the early 19th century. Curator Louise Ainmatt took me into the special viewing room.
This is the actual journal that we're looking at that she wrote up almost day by day. The writing is lovely, very tiny to conserve paper. Not many crossings out. She seemed to have thought about what she was going to write and how she was going to express it. What's so very interesting about her account is, of course, there were no official parameters around what she was writing. It was a personalised, individualised account. She could write and say what she liked. And she did.
Je commencerai mon journal de l'instant où, quittant à minuit la maison que j'habitais à Toulon.
Rose was 23 years old when her husband Louis took command of the voyage. They had been married for around about 3 years, and unusually, they made the decision that Rose would travel with them. Highly unusual.
Dear Caroline, I shall begin my journal from the moment I left my home alone at midnight on the 16th of September, 1817. What was I thinking of? Everyone in Toulon thought I had left on the midnight coach. Instead, I had put on my men's clothing and, accompanied by Louis and one of his friends, headed for the harbour.
As she entered the boat, late at night, disguised as a boy. She had to walk through the officers who were milling around on the deck.
Someone asked who I was, and a friend said that I was his son.
And she did elicit a lot of interest, but it was clear that no one, apart from Louis and the friend who was with them, none of the officers seemed to know.
And I continued to shake with fear until we were clear of the harbour.
Word got back, and it did hit the newspapers in France. It was a scandal at the time. But she didn't maintain the pretense of travelling as a man or a boy for very long. After they left Gibraltar, which is not that far away, she emerged as Rose, the commander's wife.
Gibraltar.
The expedition's artist, Jacques Arago, also kept a journal of the voyage.
Our angelic companion was pretty, of a delicate constitution, and was a slim figure. The one gentle voice among all the others that were forced to be harsh, to make themselves heard above the crashing waves and howling winds.
Arago was a playful fellow who kept the crew amused with his tricks and music. He also became a great admirer of Madame de Freycinet.
As she stepped on the deck, The men showed their respect by ceasing their usual oaths, a tribute that the captain's wife would acknowledge with a pleasant smile. But soon, their normal curses would break forth. Then, Madame de Freshnet, turning troubled eyes on the waves, would appear to be listening to the soft swishing of the water. It was highly embarrassing to everybody, but also amusing. The commandant was not in a position to show resentment, for Madame, strictly speaking, was not on board.
It was a huge risk to his career to take his wife on the voyage. When Louis's account was published officially, there's no mention of Rose in the text, and Arago's drawings have Rose excised as well.
Cape Town.
From the top of this mountain, Cape Town reminds me of Holland. It looks so trim and regular.
You see in his drawing Rose and Louis disembarking from the ship and stepping ashore. But in their prints for engraving for the publication, Rose was discreetly left out. So it's like an early 19th century Photoshop, if you like. They just cut her out.
But publishing his scientific results many years later, when no harm could come from a reference to his wife, Louis de Freycinet recorded that he named some geographical points after someone extremely dear to him.
Mother, I am pleased to inform you that we have discovered a small island that does not appear on the most recent charts.
It may be a short quarter of a league in circumference. A few trees crown its summit, on which thousands of birds take refuge. Let us see. What shall we call it? Let it be a flowery name. Shall it be Green Island? Red Island? Or... No. I suppose it will be...
The commander has named it Rose Island. It is done. My name has been linked with a small corner of the world.
Rose Island.
Voilà. Mon nom attaché à un petit point du globe.
Bourbon to Shark Bay.
This six-week crossing of the Indian Ocean is one of the saddest. They won't be able to receive any news or letters until we reach Port Jackson. The first ones I will have in 2 years.
New Holland.
What an address!
Dampier Bay.
Shark Bay. September 1818.
There's the quite specific interest of stops they made in Australia, so on the Australian continent. First, on the west coast.
We saw the low and arid coast of New Holland. There was nothing in the sight to ease our minds, for we knew we would find no water in this miserable land. When first we landed, we saw on top of the sand hills that edged the beach a troop of savages, quite naked and armed with spears. They threatened us, gesturing us to go back to the ship.
At a complete loss of what to do, a few officers from the Uranie began to dance, led by Jacques Arago, performing on his castanets. The indigenous people responded by knocking their spears together, and an elder also began to dance. And so an uneasy peace was established. The next day, unaware that two of the ship's officers were lost on an inland excursion, Rose at last had a good day to describe to her friend.
Dear Caroline, we lunched extremely well on the excellent oysters that we found on the rocks.
Rose describes this beautiful occasion where they're on the beach at Shark Bay. This is in September 1818. And they have their own food from the ship, But she describes sitting down on the rocks on the beach with her glass of wine that she rests in the sand, and she's shucking oysters directly off the rocks and eating them. And she makes the comment, they put up a sail to put up shelter from the sun. We lunched perfectly well, not only on what had come from the ship, but also on some excellent oysters that we found.
Certainly those that I have eaten in Paris at table did not seem to me so good as those I ate seated on a rock, my glass and my plate on the sand.
We can imagine it very easily, but in the subsequent published versions of Rose's journal, very personal snippets like that have been removed. With this particular excerpt, I do wonder whether it's because it's just not terribly ladylike for a woman to be sitting on the beach with her skirts, probably hiked up a bit, shucking oysters directly off a rock and eating them.
While Rose was enjoying seafood and wine by the water, the two hungry and thirsting officers stumbled back into camp. They'd lost their sense of direction, nearly lost their lives, and one of them had lost his trousers. Observations finished and all safe on board, it was time to head north, and not soon enough for Rose.
Dear mother, it had been without a single regret that I left the hell on earth, the west coast of New Holland.
Timor de Molucas? The Marianne Islands? Guam?
A very detailed map of Oceania would be required, if one existed, to know where we are. Every day I am told that Louis corrects geographical positions erroneously recorded until now. A fact that would not surprise anyone in this part of the world, where it seems the Creator has sown islands as in our field he sows dust.
It is part of that whole broader picture of European exploration of the Pacific region. The French were constantly playing catch-up with the British, a little bit like in the 20th century, the mid-20th century, the US and the USSR were competing with each other in the space race. That's a little bit like what was going on between France and Britain in the Pacific race, I suppose.
The Papuan Islands. The Sandwich Islands.
The French found the Pacific Islands intriguing and their inhabitants unpredictable. The island of Ombai was no exception, as Jacques Arago wrote in his journal.
What was it that saved us from peril? It was our gaiety. One menacing gesture on our part, one shout, one impatient movement, and we would have been massacred and devoured. But soon, one warrior was sitting in front of me having his portrait done. I then got out my castanets and box of magic tricks.
I shudder when I see on maps how far science has taken us. We're now closer to California than the east coast of New Holland, to which we are now headed.
After spending over a year taking scientific readings and collecting specimens throughout the Pacific, they were all greatly relieved to see the east coast of New South Wales. Lachlan Macquarie was almost 10 years into his governorship of the new colony.
18th November, 1819. Sydney. Port Jackson.
Mother, I cannot go to bed without telling you at last, we are anchored in Neutral Bay, not far from the town of Sydney. Louis is now discussing the usual formalities with the port captain, Monsieur Piper.
At 8 o'clock this evening, anchored in Port Jackson in Neutral Bay, the French corvette, the Uranie, commanded by Monsieur Louis de Fregenet from Old France on discoveries, but direct from the Sandwich Islands. This ship sailed from France 2.5 years ago. The Uranie mounts guns and is manned with 120 men, being about 500 tons.
important affairs, and a salute occupied Louis until 10 o'clock, when he went himself to pay his respects to Major Lachlan Macquarie, governor of this colony.
At 10 o'clock, Monsieur de Fragenet, with all of his officers, 14 in number, paid me a visit of ceremony at Government House and delivering me a letter of introduction from the Right Honourable Earl Bathurst, Secretary of State for the Colonies.
I can see that this day in port will be as agreeable and exciting for us as our last passage was wearisome and monotonous.
She was invited by the Pipers, the Fields, the Macquaries, the MacArthurs. She was invited by everyone who was anyone, really, in Sydney.
Tuesday. I went down to Sydney early this morning in the carriage to pay a visit of ceremony to Monsieur de Fragenet, commander of the French corvette Uranie. I was accompanied by Lieutenant Governor Erskine and Major Druitt. I gave Monsieur de Fragenet and his lady an invitation to come to spend some days with myself and Mrs. Macquarie at Parramatta, which they accepted, agreeing to come up on Thursday next.
Monsieur Macquarie, who ordinarily resides in Sydney, has been for some time living in the governor's chateau at Parramatta, 15 miles from here.
I ordered the government barge to be then in attendance to convey them to Parramatta early in the morning of that day.
A delightful barge belonging to the governor awaited for us at 9 o'clock in the morning. And we'd scarcely reached the arm of the seas when we saw a craft that seemed to pursue ours. It was a compliment from the governor, who sent a regimental band to enliven our way. This doubled the pleasure that we found in gazing at the truly romantic landscape that rolled itself before our eyes.
Sydney was a bit of a social whirl for the de Freycinets, probably for Rose a little bit more than Louis. Louis was...
Louis, putting his work before everything, even an invitation to lunch with the Macquaries.
Very conscientious. He had work to do, he had things to achieve. And there was one occasion where it was a cloudy day, it was very overcast, so it wasn't terribly good for the sorts of observations he had to do anyway. So he did agree to catch a boat out to Parramatta with Rose, and the plan was to visit Lachlan and Elizabeth Macquarie, the governor and his wife. They got to Parramatta, the sun came out, Louis thought, this is a wasted opportunity, and he turned around and went back to Sydney.
Madame Macquarie has much merit. In this house reigns a very agreeable air of simple elegance. We were the only ladies at dinner. So at the end of the meal, Madame Macquarie suggested we walk in the garden. We met about 30 native children who are educated and brought up at government expense. Many of them already know how to read, write, reckon, and draw very well. This settlement was founded by the present governor and, like the orphan school, is under the supervision of Madame Macquarie. The advances they have made are truly astonishing. These children will carry to the homes of their families the germs of civilization.
While Rose was given an overview of Sydney's progress, Arago was also out and about, becoming giddy with the new colony's sights and sounds.
I am enchanted. Magnificent hotels, majestic mansions, houses of extraordinary taste and elegance, fountains ornamented with sculptures worthy of the chisel of our best artists, spacious and airy apartments, rich furniture, horses, carriages of the greatest elegance, immense storehouses. Would you expect to find all these 4,000 leagues from Europe? Oh, I fancied myself transported into one of our handsomest cities.
Yeah, well, Sydney way back then had its good side and its bad side. But the French on a number of expeditions, but including this one, are notable for commenting with surprise and almost awe about what they found, about how developed the settlement was, how beautiful it was, how beautiful the setting was, the standard of the housing.
You would imagine that our best architects had deserted Europe for New Holland to reproduce their most elegant designs.
John Piper's Henrietta Villa at Point Piper. She visited all of those villas, and they were extraordinary.
The spacious residence of the governor is surrounded by magnificent gardens. To the right of his palace, but at a great distance, appears the regular front of the superb barracks, built of brick and stone.
She was, however, slightly bewildered by the governor's stables, the conservatorium of today.
It looks just like an old fortress with towers, battlements, and so on. No one could tell us what the governor had in mind when he had it built.
Rose toured and socialised, and Arago sketched and swooned, while Lachlan Macquarie did as much as he could to accommodate the Uranese scientists.
Naturalists and botanists belonging to the French expedition arrived at Parramatta from Sydney at 11 o'clock.
Several officers of our ship have undertaken a journey to the Blue Mountains.
To Bathurst. They were accompanied by Lieutenant Lawson, who kindly took them under his protection. I have, on the part of government, furnished those three scientific French gentlemen with three saddle horses and two pack horses properly equipped for carrying their provisions and baggage, and also with two government men as guides and horsekeepers.
One can be certain of interesting investigations in natural history.
My attention was distracted by the irregular noise of the swift kangaroo, which, resting on its tail and its long hind feet, leaped over edges and bushes. Everything was new to me, trees and animals, and I cannot express the magic charm I felt. Scarcely a leaf resembled the productions of our country. I was a stranger to everything.
Another ball on the 16th of December, and the room was emblazoned with the coat of arms of France and England, as well as those of Louis' family. On the parquet had been painted Cook's ship, the Endeavour, Mr. King's mermaid, and the Uranie.
It does also tell us a lot about class and protocol and society and stepping in and out of those restrictions.
Here, above all places, he who is at the distance of the earth's diameter from his native land is neither Russian, nor Spaniard, nor Englishman, nor Frenchman. Here, all are Europeans, and all are countrymen.
What comes out so clearly of the period that Rose and Louis were in Sydney was how much personal relationships and personalities underwrote the politics of Sydney and the social life of Sydney, and how free and easy they were and genuinely affectionate the British and the French were, despite being from nations that were competing with each other specifically in this area. And this was a period when the whole idea of Australia was still seeping through to European consciousness.
And to cap off their visit, the French put on a party of their own.
We decided to offer a dinner on board to everyone from whom we had received civilities. Louis had two salons prepared, decorated with flags and garlands of flowers. We borrowed the regimental band and it played military airs throughout the meal. At dessert, Louis proposed the health of George III, which was accompanied by 21 guns. Then followed a ceremony in celebration of Louis XVIII. There was joyous uproar throughout the ship. Our cook was less happy. He despaired that everything was ruined. With limited space, he placed all his desserts on a plank on a cannon.
Sunday, 26 December, 1819. Early this morning, the French corvette Uranie, commanded by Monsieur le Capitaine de Fregenet, sailed from Port Jackson on her return to Old France.
I was extremely sad to be leaving Sydney. The thought of sailing around Cape Horn frightened me. And to rekindle my courage, I had to remind myself of the fact that we were sailing towards France once more.
But unfortunately, disaster struck. Shortly after rounding treacherous Cape Horn, the Uranie hit rocks and the crew was shipwrecked for months in the Falkland Islands. They made it back to France in October 1820, just over 3 years since their departure. An admirer of Madame de Fregenet till the end, on her death just 12 years later from tuberculosis, Jacques Arago lamented.
And in return for so much inconvenience, for facing so many dangers, for such deprivation, what recompense did she receive? What glory was hers?
What was it about her that made her unwilling to sit at home and wait, like all the other wives? She did write about it towards the end of her life as the greatest adventure of her lifetime.
I had to choose between my affections and the general prejudices, which could only be challenged with the certainty of being criticized by the majority. I chose the solution which, in my view, would bring the greatest happiness to my friend Louis and to me. Life is too short. I wanted to brighten it up as much as possible, and I shall never regret the decision which I took. Tandis que, si j'eusse agi différemment, peut-être ne sais-je que des regrets.
And on RN's Earshot podcast, you've been listening to The Appearance of Rose de Fregenet. Rose's journal and letters were read by Ming Zhu He. James Saunders read from the writings of artist Jacques Arago and Governor Lachlan Macquarie. And you also heard Louise Ainmatt, curator with the State Library of New South Wales. The program was produced by Ros Blewett with sound engineer Judy Rapley. And you can check the website for photographs of the intrepid explorers and much more information. And yes, this has been another Earshot podcast. If you'd like to hear more stories like this one, then find us via the ABC Radio app or just head to the program webpage and take a tour through our increasingly rich back catalogue of stories about people and places and ideas. You can download and listen whenever, wherever you like. Earshot, your audio story companion. And I'm your devoted presenter. My name is David Rutledge. Thanks for your company. I'll see you next time.